The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Today on the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. Israel is under attack.
The conflict we are seeing is the direct result of the tragic mistakes of the Biden foreign policy.
Will the United States defend our longtime ally?
Now is the time for the Biden administration to step back and look at the fundamental choice that they have when it comes to the Middle East.
Meanwhile, the markets crash as many of the unemployed refuse to work.
There's no surprise that the employment report was so awful.
And cable news takes a big hit.
The CNN search was just all about Trump. It always was. It was about anger at Trump. It did get people to watch CNN for a little bit, and now they're gone.
I'm Hugh Hewitt. Great to be with you. Catch my program each weekday morning live, 6 to 9 a.m. Eastern Time, and on demand 24/7. Learn more at HughHewitt.com. And follow me on Twitter, at Hugh Hewitt. Follow this program as well, at Town Hall Review. Rarely has a week come when so many crises arrived at the same time. Gas shortages across the East. The market slumps as jobs report turns south and inflation heads north. And Israel, our longtime and dear ally, faces a brutal enemy at their border. We'll start there. The terror group Hamas, interwoven among Palestinian residents in the Gaza Strip, began launching missiles at civilian targets in Israel. The Israeli defense system, known as Iron Dome, managed to intercept many of the rockets. But hundreds have been fired and some have hit their targets, killing Israelis. I spoke this week with Senator Ted Cruz on the Hugh Hewitt Show. Do you think Team Biden is doing anything remotely like they ought to be doing?
Well, I do think it is a powerful lesson for everyone about cause and effect and that American leadership matters. You know, we had 4 years of Donald Trump as president. And when it came to the Middle East, when it came to Israel, President Trump's approach is the one that I emphatically urged him, which is for America to stand unequivocally alongside Israel. There was a big battle early in the Trump administration about whether to move our embassy to Jerusalem. Both the State Department and Defense Department didn't want to do it. I urged the president that the right thing to do was move the embassy. He agreed, and the most powerful reason, I believe, to move the embassy was it made clear to our friends and our enemies that we stand unshakably with Israel. That led, the very same week we opened our embassy, to the most important foreign policy decision Trump made, which is pulling out of the disastrous Obama-Iran nuclear deal. Just as with the embassy, both state and defense opposed pulling out of the deal. I urged the president to pull out of the deal. He agreed with me and did. That resulted in a flowering of peace in the Middle East. The Abraham Accords, historic peace deals. I spoke to you with the foreign ministers and ambassadors of UAE and Bahrain. Both of them said virtually the identical thing as they signed the Abraham Accords. They said, it is now clear to us that America stands with Israel. We want to be friends with America. Therefore, we will be friends with Israel. And it was exactly the argument that had played out for 4 years. We saw peace in the Middle East for 4 years. What happens? Joe Biden gets elected. His number one foreign policy priority is to reinstate the catastrophic Obama-Iran nuclear deal. And they're already engaged in this strategic ambiguity where they can't decide if they're with Israel or the Palestinians. Biden has already sent over $100 million to the Palestinian Authority, which is in a unity government with Hamas, which is paying terrorists who are murdering Israelis and murdering their families, contrary to the Taylor Force Law, which I helped pass, which prohibits U.S. tax dollars from going to organizations that fund terrorists. And this is the result. The conflict we are seeing is the direct result of the tragic mistakes of the Biden foreign policy. And when you are ambiguous, when you are agonizing. When you undermine our support for Israel, what happens is it encourages the terrorists who attack and launch the kind of missile and rocket attacks that we're seeing right now. It is exceptionally dangerous. And unfortunately, I fear there's a good chance it will get worse because Biden is not going to change and is going to continue for 4 years to systematically undermine Israel.
Wisconsin Congressman Mike Gallagher is a member of the House Armed Services Committee. We discuss more of what the United States must do to support Israel. Congressman Gallagher, what do you make of the news out of Israel?
Well, I see it in the broader regional framework. I see this and I don't see Israel versus Hamas. I see the U.S. alliance structure versus Iran. And I would encourage everyone to stay focused on Iran. We know that Iran has a history of co-opting local grievances, whether it's the Houthi rebels in Yemen or whether it's Hamas, even a Sunni terrorist organization like Hamas, in order to draw a wedge between Israel and the rest of the countries in the region, as in order to advance their overall goal, which is the destruction of the state of Israel. And the other thing I would encourage your listeners to follow is if you think that these rockets from Hamas present a grave threat to the nation of Israel, and God bless Iron Dome and all of the scientific cooperation that led to its development, this pales in comparison to the rockets, the advanced rockets that Hezbollah has diligently built up in southern Lebanon and southern Syria over the last few years, really building what could be described as the largest military facility in the world. And what they've done is just as barbaric as Hamas. They've hid these advanced rockets under densely populated civilian areas in order, when they provoke violence, to provoke a response from the Israeli government that will have collateral damage that will invite the condemnation of the international community. It's why it's so important that the Biden administration use the authorities we gave them in the last Congress. We passed a bill authored by myself and Tom Suozzi to designate those with sanctions who are using this barbaric practice of human shields. But the Trump administration didn't designate anyone. We believe that the Biden administration can use that authority to start applying some financial pressure in order to eradicate this barbaric practice. The final thing I'd say, Hugh, is just a simple statement that, you know, a democratic army puts itself between its civilian population and the enemy, but a terrorist army puts its civilian population between itself and the enemy. And that's what we're watching happen here.
I spent a half hour talking with former Israeli ambassador to the United States, Dr. Michael Oren, about what is going on. He's in Tel Aviv. He spent the night in his bomb shelter. They had a race riot in Lod. Three synagogues burned to the ground with the Arab Israeli population turning on the Jewish Israeli population in a hitherto unknown sort of conflagration. At the same time, they haven't called up enough reserves, according to Dr. Oren, that would signal a ground invasion of Gaza. But they have killed a significant amount of the leadership structure of the Hamas military, and all's quiet on the northern front. How do you read the situation there from afar? And you're obviously going to have better sources than I am.
Yeah, I'd admit it's still hard to read it. I've been talking to some people I know in Israel over the last 48 hours. Really, it just comes down to how much Hamas wants to escalate this and thereby force Israel to take perhaps more drastic action. I just would say that now is the time for the United States to be unwavering in our support for Israel, to push back on some of these dangerous narratives that I see emerging from the American left, that Israel is somehow indiscriminately attacking Palestinian civilian populations, which, of course, we know is not the case. Hugh, I was in Israel during Operation Protective Edge some 7 years ago, and I got an in-depth understanding of how targeted and deliberative the Israeli military is and how what lengths they go to in order to avoid civilian casualties. And I can tell you that it is incredibly effective, and they would not be taking action were they not being provoked by a terrorist group. And I really do think that now is the time for the Biden administration to step back and look at the fundamental choice that they have when it comes to the Middle East. Down one path, they could just build upon the success of the Abraham Accords, enhance the really historic cooperation between Israel and the Sunni Arab Gulf states, which I actually think over time gives you your best chance to solve the Middle East peace process problem from the bottom up rather than the top down, a regionally focused approach. Or they can continue to go down this path of the Obama third term, of putting the JCPOA back together with duct tape, of believing that somehow we need to reach a new equilibrium in the Middle East by actually empowering Iran, and in some ways rejecting the Abraham Accords entirely. And that really is the fundamental choice they're facing right now. And I fear that they're rejecting the Abraham Accords in favor of reviving the JCPOA. And this is just the beginning of the chaos that we're going to see in the region as a result of it. The other thing I think we need to do is put all the information out there that is available, potentially declassifying intelligence if we have it, that could trace these rockets back to Iran. I do believe that ultimately you are going to find that trail back to Iran's support for Hamas. It's well documented. It's historical. I think we would do well to put that information out into the public sphere to let everybody know what's actually going on here and further enhance that regional alliance structure that I was talking about, Hugh.
Now, Dr. Oren confirmed what I had seen, which is at the beginning of this, when it was a Temple Mount problem and riot, that some of the Abraham Accord partners with Israel wavered, including Bahrain, but that once Hamas attacked Tel Aviv and central Israel, the Hamas alienated the Abraham Accord partners who were concerned with attacks on the Temple Mount and Dome of the Rock. That would be reassuring. However, there's a lead headline in the Times of Israel that Team Biden is trying to have it every way that they can. They want to be friends with Hamas. They want to be friends with Iran. They want to be friends with the Israelis. But it's not working. You can't be friends with everyone in the Middle East.
You can't. And, you know, we had earlier a readout from a conversation between the National Security Advisor and their Israeli counterpart that prior to this violence occurring, that said the United States was expressing serious concern about a pending eviction of a number of Palestinian families from their homes in a certain neighborhood in Jerusalem, and then the violent clashes on the Temple Mount. And again, I think this is a situation where the administration can't try and be too cute and thread some impossible needle through all of this. It's as simple as standing by your friends and punishing your enemies. And our friends are Israel. We have other allies in the region, and our enemies are Iran and Salafi jihadist terrorist groups like Hamas. And it's that simple. We have to support our friends and punish our enemies. And we have to build our entire regional approach based on that simple framework. And that's what the Trump administration did quite effectively. And I think even their harshest critics have to give them credit for the historic cooperation between Israel and Saudi Arabia and other Sunni Arab Gulf states. And so to reject that approach, to me, just makes absolutely no sense.
Coming up, Republicans warn the unemployment checks were dangerously high.
There's no surprise that the employment report was so awful.
The Town Hall Review returns in a moment.
As we consider a post-COVID world, the call goes forth to a new generation of leaders in politics and policy. I'm Pete Peterson, Dean of Pepperdine's Graduate School of Public Policy. And for over two decades, we've prepared students to apply America's founding principles to today's policy debates. Are you considering graduate school? Find out more at pepperdine.edu/SPP. That's pepperdine.edu/SPP.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Democrats led by President Biden have managed to pull off the seemingly impossible, and in 4 months, high unemployment along with record demand for workers. It takes remarkable effort to achieve both of those at the same time. It's like having hot and cold water in the same glass. In a true free market society, it's simply impossible. But Democrats are printing money. They extended high unemployment benefits to people originally laid off by the lockdown who are now reluctant to return to work. Some have decided to go back to work. They prefer a job, but not enough to generate the million new jobs that was expected in last month. In fact, it came in at about 250,000. Combine that number, that disappointment, with the inflation fueled by printing of money, and the market took a tumble this week. Salem host Larry Elder discussed the economic mess with UCLA professor Leo Hanian.
Not a single one of the administrators in the Obama administration that I saw said that maybe, just maybe, we've created a disincentive on the part of workers not to work.
No, Larry, that's exactly right. The employment report was just devastatingly negative. I have never seen a forecast error by 700 or 800,000 jobs. When that forecast was made 1 or 2 days before the data was released, that was a complete jaw dropper. It's because of economic policies. It's because the people are not sufficiently incentivized to be finding jobs right now. And teachers' unions are keeping schools closed. So when you take into account both the failure to open schools and the fact that Washington, D.C. is just printing money left and right and sending it out in checks to people, there's no surprise that the employment report was so awful. And the stock market went up on Friday for the most perverse reason, because what the stock market should be responding to foundational, legitimate economic news. Instead, the stock market is going up because they think the Fed will continue just to print money left and right. This is, Larry, I thought the Obama administration policies were the worst I'd ever seen in my lifetime. These ones under Biden and Janet Yellen and Jerome Powell are just so much worse.
CNN Business has an article headline, "Prices are rising everywhere you look." Year to year, prices are up 2.6%. Now, that's higher than the 2% that the Fed said was their ideal number.
Exactly. Their target is 2%. Year over year is 2.6%. In March, it was annualized at 7%. And the New York Federal Reserve Bank conducts a public survey every month, and they're finding that within the public, they're expecting inflation between 3 and 3.5% over the next 3 years. So the Fed is doing a poor job of keeping prices stable. And as you noted, wherever you look, prices are up. Lumber prices, oil prices, copper prices. There are a number of shortages. And the Fed just keeps having their head in the sand and saying, well, we have inflation under control and we have no plans whatsoever to stop printing money.
Professor, there is an article in Bloomberg headlined, "Job Paradox Baffles Economists as U.S. Employers See Shortage." When you see a headline like that, "Baffles Economists," and you're an economist, I'm sure your reaction has got to be, "I ain't baffled."
No, there's no surprise whatsoever. This is, economics is really simple, and it's really clear that there's no one in Washington advising Biden who has the necessary training and experience to be providing good guidance. No one. There's absolutely no one who has any background in this area. And it's just very, very simple. It is very, very simple. The incentives aren't there. Schools aren't open. What's going to push people out the door to accept those jobs when checks are coming in and when their kids can't go to school? It's as clear as day. And yet, President Biden runs around saying, well, the fact that the employment report was so bad means that we need even more of the same medicine that we're providing to the economy. Larry, who does that sound like? That sounded like President Obama back in 2009 and 10 and 11 and 12 and 13. And the years just kept going on with the slowest recovery we've ever had. We're getting the same type of failed policies under President Biden, but at a factor of about 4 or 5 times greater than what we saw under President Obama.
Professor, the Bloomberg article to which I just now referenced said, quote, "Anyone who made less than $32,000 per year is better off financially in the near term receiving unemployment benefits."
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And there's no surprise about that, because we had seen the same type of patterns coming from Western and Northern Europe for the last 30 to 40 years, because unemployment benefits were extremely generous. So there just wasn't the incentive to get people out there taking jobs.
Cable news ratings came out this week, and the results were startling. Turns out the worst thing that happened to many of them was the end of the Trump administration. I spoke with Washington Examiner's Byron York. The drop CNN is experiencing ratings is profound. So we're talking about more than 2/3 of the audience gone. What is happening there, Byron York?
It was all about Trump. I mean, their surge was all about Trump. And it didn't end with the election. That was the whole, because of the way Trump contested the election and how angry all of that time became, they did even better. Now, I am a Fox News contributor, and I looked at these ratings in which CNN was doing very well. Fox was not doing as well. It was a complete change from the way it had been the year before. And I was concerned, but I thought, you know, let's just wait. There's going to be a Democratic president. This period is going to calm down, and the law of gravity will reassert itself. And boy, has it. I think one of the things Joe was looking at is you look at the daily ratings of all the cable news programs. And now, as it was in the past, you look at the top 10, eight of them are Fox. There are a couple of MSNBC programs. The highest CNN-rated program, the highest, is about 25th. And so that's kind of the way it used to be. And so the CNN surge, which, as you know, you follow Brian Stelter and others that were really crowing about as if something huge and permanent had happened, the CNN surge was just all about Trump. It always was. It was about anger at Trump. It did get people to watch CNN for a little bit, and now they're gone.
Now, Jeff Zucker is a very smart guy, and I like him, and I work with CNN. I'm an NBC News contributor like you're a Fox News contributor, so people have to count. We're not trashing a fellow network. We're just reporting on a story, and we both know something about it. Here's the deal. If you were running a Tom Brady quarterback store in Boston, downtown Boston, you had a store devoted to selling Tom Brady merchandise, and all you sold was Tom Brady merchandise, and then Tom Brady goes to Tampa Bay, I mean, just leaves. Do you keep selling Tom Brady New England Patriot merchandise, or do you change? And I don't think they understand that, Byron, because they're not changing.
Well, you know, I did have to wonder. I wondered at various times. Obviously, CNN went, you know, full resistance, as did MSNBC. And you can have an opinion of who did resistance better, but that's what they did. CNN has had poor ratings, except for this period that we're talking about, which they did well. They've had poor ratings for quite a while.
Coming up, the shutdown of the Colonial Pipeline.
We are under constant attack.
The Town Hall Review returns in a moment. Hi, everyone. Hugh Hewitt for Bambi. That's right, Bambi. Have you heard of it before? B-A-M-B-E-E. It was created specifically for small businesses because we know that small businesses can often get sunk by HR problems. HR issues can kill your business. Well, Bambi is here to save you that problem. It is specifically designed for small business. You get a dedicated HR manager, craft your HR policy, and maintain your compliance all for just $99 a month. Now, I've run a couple of law firms, I run a foundation, and I run a business. And I know that HR is a headache. It doesn't have to be. Bambi can change it from a headache to a profit center overnight. From onboarding to termination, Bambi will customize your policies to fit your business. Go to Bambi.com/townhall right now to schedule your free HR audit. That's Bambi.com/townhall. Bambee.com/townhall. Bambee.com/townhall. You'll be glad you did. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. When hackers stopped the flow of the Colonial Pipeline fuel, there was initially little public concern. Then gas stations began running out of gas. And like the COVID toilet paper run, the panic began. Gas stations saw miles of lines, and soon many in southern states were empty. Daniel Briette served as United States Secretary of Energy from 2019 to 2021. He was on with Chris Stegall on AM 990, The Answer, out of Philadelphia.
I'm concerned, I won't lie, particularly as I hear our neighbors to the south in the Carolinas are issuing emergency declarations. I'm seeing these gas lines and wondering, you know, when I hear a pipeline is hacked, half the nation's supply is now being monkeyed with, for want of a better term. It sounds pretty dire. Is this surprising to you that this happened?
Well, unfortunately, it's not terribly surprising because we've known about these vulnerabilities for quite some time. We've been working closely. When I was Secretary of Energy, we worked closely with the private industry to fix some of the issues that we saw. We have some real adversaries in the world today, Chris. As you know, you and I have talked about this in the past. Russia, China, Iran, North Korea, they don't like us very much. And we are under constant attack. And one of the things that they know and they have been very aggressive about is attacking our critical infrastructure. And this pipeline is perhaps one of the most critical parts of our energy infrastructure in the United States. As you pointed out, over half of the refined product, diesel, gasoline, jet fuel, goes through that pipeline, and it goes up to places like Philadelphia, New York, down from Houston. You know, what we're seeing today is unfortunately something that we predicted some time ago, and it's very important that the private industry step up, fix some of these issues quickly.
So the owners of this pipeline, Colonial, is that they own it?
Colonial, correct.
Would you put then this hack on the back of Colonial and say you didn't do enough to thwart it or ward it off in advance?
No, I don't think it's something that we need to blame them for. It's something that we need to all together as Americans recognize is a real threat to us. China is not our friend. Iran is not our friend. North Korea is not our friend. Russia is not our friend. And we need to recognize that, and it's both Americans and the folks in the energy business and private sector energy business. We need to take appropriate steps to protect not only our intellectual property and the things that we do well here in America, the innovation that we bring to market, we have to protect that as well. We also have to protect the physical infrastructure, and in this case, it's a pipeline.
When our adversaries run test runs like this, it kind of demonstrates to the world how vulnerable we are, does it not?
It does, and as we've begun to put much of our lives online, we've made ourselves vulnerable in that sense. And, you know, we need to think about that as well. I know it's very convenient to get on your iPhone, and it's very, you know, convenient to use things like online banking. We all do it. But we need to understand we're making ourselves vulnerable when we do that, especially if we allow the manufacture of certain types of products to be done in foreign countries. For instance, when I was Secretary of Energy, we noticed that in what's called our bulk power part of the grid, it's the part of the electricity grid that provides the enormous amounts of electricity that goes across those big transmission towers. We noticed that in some of the transformers that were being made in China, there were certain components in certain parts of the equipment that just didn't belong there. Well, lo and behold, you know, they were there because the Chinese were manufacturing the transformer and they were putting in data collection units that were sending information back to Beijing. We need to be aware of those things and, again, to understand that to the extent that we move this type of manufacturing, especially for our critical infrastructure, over to places like China, who is our adversary, we make ourselves vulnerable.
Does this not open up the conversation to how do we supply enough energy? How is there a backup? How is there not a backup, I guess? How do you cripple half the country's energy needs in one hack? And what can we do better?
It helps to understand the history of the Colonial Pipeline and how do we get here. One of the reasons we got here was because refining was shut down in places like New York and candidly in Pennsylvania as well. And when you shut down those types of facilities, you make yourself dependent upon others who continue to refine product like gasoline and diesel and jet fuel. And that's done in places like Houston and other parts of the country. So that product has to be shipped to the Northeast if you're not going to make it locally. We've closed down refining in the Northeast. We've closed down the ability to build pipelines into places like New York, the Marcellus Shale. You and I have talked about this. Yes. In the past, Pennsylvania is blessed with natural resources, yet you can't get it to places like Boston because the state of New York will not allow the permitting of a pipeline through their state. It's those types of things that we have to address as Americans. If we're going to protect ourselves, if we're going to have energy security, if we're going to have economic security, it's important that this infrastructure be built.
For more of the discussion between Stegall and Briette, go to townhallreview.com. Coming up, Disney pushes critical race theory.
You have a dominant vehicle to bring people joy, and you decided to screw the country.
Dennis Prager, when the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment.
As we consider a post-COVID world, the call goes forth to a new generation of leaders in politics and policy. I'm Pete Peterson, Dean of Pepperdine's Graduate School of Public Policy. And for over two decades, we've prepared students to apply America's founding principles to today's policy debates. Are you considering graduate school? Find out more at pepperdine.edu/SPP. That's pepperdine.edu/SPP.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Though they have certainly drifted leftward over the decades, Disney is still viewed positively by the majority of the public. That may not last long. The corporation has, for years, had an internal struggle as the left and the right battled for control of content. At least for today, it appears the far left won that battle. Dennis Prager evaluates this troubling trend at Disney. He begins by reading from an article on the situation from Christopher Ruffo in the City Journal.
It is impossible to overstate the damage Disney is doing to this country. If not monopoly, you have a dominant vehicle to bring people joy, and you've decided to screw the country instead, to bring in anger rather than joy. Disney executives have elevated the ideology of critical race theory into a new corporate dogma, bombarded employees with trainings on systemic racism, white privilege, white fragility, and white saviors, and launched racially segregated affinity groups at the company's headquarters called Reimagine Tomorrow, which paints a disturbing picture of the company's embrace of racial politics. The core of Disney's racial program is a series of training modules on anti-racism. In one called Allyship for Race Consciousness, the company tells employees that they must, quote, take ownership of educating themselves about structural anti-black racism, and they should not rely on their black colleagues to educate them because it is, quote, emotionally taxing. Do you hear this mumbo-jumbo? By the way, every black with dignity should loathe Disney. The left does not see black human beings as real. You are simply useful pawns. It's emotionally taxing for a black colleague to educate. You can't ask a black colleague, please tell me in what way you are systemically abused or discriminated against. I want to understand better because it's emotionally taxing. The United States, the document claims, has, quote, a long history of systemic racism and transphobia. Really? The fact that 99.99999% of Americans would not have understood the term 5 years ago is not relevant. And white employees in particular must, quote, work through their feelings of guilt, shame, and defensiveness. I guess, what would I do if I were at Disney? I have neither guilt, shame, nor defensiveness. All of this is meaningless. This is Maoist talk. That's all it is. It's the same as the Cultural Revolution in China. Disney recommends that employees atone by challenging colorblind ideologies. You hear that? That's their words. Colorblind is the essence of the liberal message on color. I used to brag that I ate Ben & Jerry's ice cream because I only cared about the product, not the views. But when Disney becomes so destructive of society, there is literally only one answer. Boycott them. Do not use their product, do not watch their movies, and especially do not visit Disney World and Disneyland, which is very painful because you want to take your kids there. So there are other amusement parks. A childhood can be spent without having gone to Disneyland. Disney stinks. It is hurting this country. They are espousing evil. Do you understand how immoral what they say is? It's immoral. That you should not be colorblind is their position. That is immoral. Let us call it what it is. In another module called What Can I Do About Racism, Disney tells employees that they should reject equality. And instead, this is the key, strive for equity with a focus on the equality of outcome. Equality of outcome is communism. Equality of opportunity is American. The challenge begins with information on systemic racism and ask participants to accept that they have, quote, all been raised in a society that elevates white culture over others. What is white culture? They never define it. Do you understand that? They never define it. Tell me, what is white culture? Is driving a Chevy white culture? Is it having children before you, after you're married? Is that white culture? Apparently it is, because that doctrine is considered racist now, to tell people to have children after they marry. Middle class values, they're the best for everybody. Get an education, get married, and have children after you marry. Is that white culture? Decades ago, Newsweek had a front page a cover article on acting white. Kids who did what I just said to you, studied hard, black kids who studied hard were called acting white. I guess, is that white culture? To study hard? Participants then learn about their white privilege and are asked to fill out a white privilege checklist with options including, I am white, I am heterosexual, I am a man, I still identify as the gender I was born in, I have never been raped, I don't rely on public transportation, and I have never been called a terrorist. That's right, if you don't rely on public transportation, you got white privilege. Well, I admit that. By and large, if you really work hard and you get married and do all these things, you will be able to afford private transportation called a car. Next, participants learn about white fragility and are asked to complete an exercise called How to Tell If You Have White Fragility. The program interprets beliefs such as, I am a good person, I can't be racist, and I was taught to treat everyone the same, as evidence of the participants' internalized racism and white fragility. I was taught to treat everyone the same is now wrong, is now evil. This is Disney. To hell with the Disney company. This is a particularly vile company. They're competing with Coca-Cola and with Delta. I mean, it's very, and United. I mean, it's a competition. The corporations are trying to outdo one another in crapping on America. In the same collection of resources, Disney also recommends that employees read a series of how-to guides, including 75 Things White People Can Do for Racial Justice. Oh, I got to get a copy of that. I love these numbers. And your kids are not too young to talk about race. That's right, of course. Indoctrinate them as early as possible into you're a piece of crap because you're white. The first article suggests that white employees should defund the police, participate in reparations, decolonize your bookshelf, and don't gentrify neighborhoods. Find and join a local white space and donate to anti-white supremacy work such as your local Black Lives Matter chapter. If you think BLM is just basically an anti-American hate group, which I do believe it is, and Disney now wants all of its employees to donate to that, when you go to Disneyland or Disney World, you are funding BLM at this time.
Coming up, the battle against the citizens of Israel is also internal.
All of a sudden, the Arab residents of Lod turned on the Jewish residents. They burnt synagogues.
The final segment of the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt when we return. If you enjoy the Town Hall Review and you are a person of faith, let me introduce you to another podcast I think you'll like. It's the Christian Outlook, and in it you'll hear the leading voices in the Christian world engaging the issue of the day. This week, Israel finds itself under a barrage of rocket fire from Hamas.
Aimed not at military targets, but aimed at civilians.
They'll look at what's behind the crisis on the southern border.
They want to register illegal aliens, they want to register non-citizens, and they want them to vote in elections.
A theological challenge within the Southern Baptist Convention.
The one who holds the teaching office is described as the husband of one wife.
And the uniqueness of the gospel message.
The good news of the gospel is in what we can't do, God has done for us. And that makes Christianity stand completely alone.
We've got all this and more. To subscribe, go to ChristianOutlook.com. That's ChristianOutlook.com. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. We began the program with a look at the attacks on our friends in Israel. We conclude with a conversation about the internal battles taking place at the same time. Michael Oren is a former Israeli ambassador to the United States, a current resident of Israel, as well as a superb historian. In the midst of air raid sirens, he took time to join me on the Hugh Hewitt Show. Can you describe for the audience that may only be watching American cable news what is going on? I mean, in Lode last night, there was what I would call a race riot in the United States. The mayor of Lode called it Kristallnacht, which is a little, I mean, bracing to see. What happened there?
Well, it's a tremendous, tremendous blow to Israelis, and I would include myself among them, who believe that there's a future of coexistence between with us, Israeli Jews and Israeli Arabs. And this is one of the many mixed towns in Israel. Lod, I live in a mixed town of Jaffa, which was quiet last night. And all of a sudden, the Arab residents of Lod turned on the Jewish residents. They burnt synagogues. They burnt three synagogues. It happened also in the ancient city of Akko, where they burned one of Israel's greatest restaurants, Buri Buri, whose owner has made his, dedicated his life to training young Arabs from poor neighborhoods how to be sous chefs.
That is truly a ferocious attack that's deeply rooted in anti-Semitism, to go after someone's houses of worship.
And not just one, but three. And one of the definitions of Zionism, Hugh, is that the Jews could have a, we could have a country in a place where synagogues wouldn't be burnt. We've had rockets before. We know how to deal with them. We know how to deal with them militarily. We know how to deal with them emotionally. This destruction, this vandalism, this anti-Semitism has left us all very shaken.
I am curious if you believe that the cycle of political instability contributed to this in any way.
I do. I think that Hamas internalized a certain political weakness here, a difficulty at decision-making, and exploited it. And I've been saying this, certainly in the Israeli press, for 2 years, that our inability to form a government actually has strategic ramifications and carries with it dangers. Because if Hamas is realizing this weakness, so too are more formidable enemies like Iran.
Speaking of Iran, Hamas is firing anti-tank missiles at civilian cars and individuals. Where do they get anti-tank missiles from?
Oh, they get it all from Iran. The vast majority of rockets that are fired at us are made in Iran. And one of the benefits of the Abraham Accords, our signing a peace treaty with Sudan, is that previously these rockets had been smuggled through Sudan across the desert. But Iran is a major, major backer of Hamas, and Iran is the exclusive owner of Islamic Jihad.
My conversation with Michael Oren is quite lengthy, worth listening to in its entirety to fully grasp what is happening. For the complete interview with Michael Oren, check out my podcast, The Interview with Hugh Hewitt, at iTunes, Spotify, and the Salem Podcast Network. Thank you for joining us on the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Catch up on earlier episodes at our website, townhallreview.com, and sign up for a daily dose of the best in talk radio. Special thanks to executive producer Russell Shubin, producers Charlie Richards, David Pouchon, Michael Cook, Alex Perez, Adam Ramsey, and Dwayne Patterson. Let me say thanks once again to our sponsor, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Thank you for joining us.